Okay, so kind of our last day, and after lunch we'll come out of the silence, and perhaps it's just worth saying that some people will have held the silence more strongly than others. So just be sort of sensitive to one another, yeah? Just because we come out of silence, it doesn't mean you have to talk. And, you know, just be a little bit sensitive, because if someone else has held the silence quite strongly for the best part of 2 weeks, suddenly being confronted with a lot of chatter can be quite distressing for people sometimes. So be a little bit sensitive to one another and to yourself, you know. You don't need to... It's a little bit of a shame if you go straight into some kind of manic phase, you know. Anyway, so just be kind to others and yourself. And, maybe go for a walk with one other person or by yourself if you want to maintain that quiet. Don't feel obliged. I feel like I want to just, in a way, express some appreciation to everybody here, just for sort of staying with it. I think it's always hard to know how subjective this is, isn't it? For me personally, it's been quite a strong, sometimes quite difficult, sometimes very... expansive journey. It's felt that we've been on this journey, this alchemical journey, this journey of the imagination together. And so, you know, thanks for being here and staying with it. You know, I woke up this morning with a cold, and my sympathy goes out for the people that have had a cold. An unpleasant one. I don't know what I want to say about the whole thing, other than I think it's best understood as a journey of the imagination. I mean, that's what it is, isn't it? It's an imaginative journey through the psyche, or with the psyche, through the possibility of the movements that happen or can happen in our psyche. And to some extent I've tried to, and Madhava has tried to sort of link it up with practice, with our Buddhist practice. And I think for me this is the big thing, is that it's to somehow understand that what we're doing when we meditate is not primarily the act of some kind of technique. Of course, sometimes it is an application of a technique, that's fine. But it's much more than that. It's really the engagement, beginning to relearn or remember, rediscover the possibility of engaging with the world through our imagination. And by imagination, we kind of mean the heart wisdom, actually, what's at the sort of core of us, and the part of us that is naturally sensitive and receptive, even, what's the word I'm looking for? What is it when something is absorbent, permeable, yes, thank you. Even sort of permeable by the world psyche, this idea that our heart or our soul or our psyche, all these words are being used rather loosely and interchangeably, which can be quite frustrating, I know, but there's a sort of idea through most of humankind's history, there's been this idea that the world has a kind of psychic reality of in and of itself. And of course, interesting enough, it re-emerged, you know, with James Lovelock. I think he died recently, didn't he? I think he died this year. Anyway, with the Gaia theory, you know, this idea that the world has somehow got some intelligence. I don't know if that's the right word. I think intelligence isn't the right word, but some psyche, and that somehow that's part of us that can be open and receptive and porous to that world psyche, that world anima. So we've been sort of trying to encourage that, I think, as something that brings meaning and colour to life. I think this is what we're trying to do. Sometimes life gets presented as if it's a problem, but life isn't really a problem, it's an experience, isn't it? Of course it will have problems, we will all have problems as we go through life, but life isn't really something to be solved. I think sometimes it's very easy to slip into this idea that there's a kind of solution. Private Eye used to, I don't know if they still had it, didn't they? They used to run a little solution column, didn't they, of all the firms and people that use this word, you know, home furnishing solutions, you know. Whatever it was, you know, I don't know if any of you used to see that in Private Eye, but it was a bit of a joke that everything needed a solution. And I think, of course, we do have solutio and chemical, but that's a little bit different. That's kind of liquefying things. But we do sometimes have this idea that life is a problem that needs to be solved, that our life is a problem that needs to be solved, and there's something out there, if only we could find it, that would solve it, you know, would make it all, well, I could say better, but I mean, it's, I don't know if that's the right thing to say, really. It would somehow, solve it. And sometimes we get involved in something like Buddhism, we have that idea that there's some sort of bit of knowledge there, or there's some teacher out there, or there's some arcane text, or there's some technique, or there's some practice, you know, these higher practices. Quite often hear people talking about these higher practices, you know, Dzogchen or whatever it happens to be, you know. I thought Dzogchen was a dog before I discovered. Probably most of you are too young to know the reference, Smirnoff advert. Anyway. Yeah, we think that's a kind of solution. But I think what we've been trying to say here is there isn't really any solution. Well, that's what I've been trying to say. There isn't really any solution. What there is life to be lived. There's your life to be lived. And that, and what I think I want to encourage, I love this word encourage, to give courage, you know, to encourage people to live their lives as fully and richly as possible. And of course, the only way we can do this is if we stop being frightened, we stop being fearful. Doesn't mean we never experience fear, but we don't live that sort of life. You know, we don't live a life where we're always trying to be safe, whether it's with money or with relationships or with everything, you know. A lot of people now, and oddly enough, I've observed this myself, the more people get, the more scared they usually become. Yeah, this is just how it is. The more you get, the more security you get, the more you worry. It's a weird, well, perhaps not that weird, actually. Perhaps that's just how it is, yeah. But you, so this idea that if you get life insurance, you're still going to die. You know, it's like you're dying, yeah. You're not going to die, you probably aren't going to die any sooner or later, you know, or if you get a, well, whatever, you know, this idea that we can make life safe. Of course, we can't make life safe, but what we can make life is meaningful and rich, and we do this by moving in, don't we, moving into our fear, moving, you know, feeling it and allowing it to energise us rather than numb us, you know. I think the main thing we don't want to happen to us in life is that we become numb, you know. That seems to me to be the main thing to be avoided. You know, you don't want to be numb. Is there anything worse than that? What's the point of living a numbed life? Yeah. And this, of course, this opening up, we want to open up to the beauty, we want to open up to the love and all this. But if we open up, we open up. We open up to all of it. We can't just open up to the good bits, either in ourselves or in the world. Yeah. If we awaken, whatever that means, if we awaken to how things are. Not some rosy picture of how things are, not some American dream or the English equivalent. I mean, we have a sort of doze, don't we? The English doze, maybe. I don't know what we have. It's not quite the same, yeah? Yeah, it's an improvement, perhaps. I don't know. But anyway, it's a bit different, you know. But you know what I mean, you know. This sort of idea that we can have this perfect life. But a perfect sort of safe life, or I don't know. So the thing that needs to be opened up mostly, it's just our imagination, just the way in which we start to imagine and enjoy the world, and particularly this idea of allowing the world, the rest of the world, to sort of have psyche. I don't know how else to put it. Well, another way it sometimes gets put is this kind of re-enchantment of the world. So when we hear these stories, whether it's a Handless Maiden or whether it's Skeleton Woman, they live in this sort of enchanted world, don't they? They inhabit this sort of enchanted world where everything possesses psyche in a way, trees, animals, you know, everything. And this is we don't have to think that this is literally, materialistically, scientifically true. We don't have to think that. That's not necessary. We can take it as a kind of playfulness, a leela, a way of being in the world in a playful, creative, imaginative way. It doesn't matter if it's true, whatever that means. I don't know what true means really in this sense. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to find it. You can't weigh it. You can't measure it. But can you weigh and measure things like beauty, belief, or love, or care? Well, surely these are the things that make human life worth anything. Yeah? They're always things that can't really be measured, can't really be put under a microscope, can't really say, well, there it is, that make life meaningful and worth living. Yeah? And they're things that all participate in what we're calling imagination. They all participate in the capacity of the heart to come into a felt, imaged relationship with other things. Yeah? This is the heart is the organ of relationship, yeah? And its relationship is largely through imaginative image. I mean that in the broadest sort of way. And I hope in the rituals, in the evenings, you've got at least a little taste of that, yeah? Because that's what ritual's for. We have ritual because somehow ritual confers on everything the intensity of reality that it has, which we normally don't notice. So in the Tibetan tradition, they call it Vajra. This is what Vajra means. You know, they have Vajra bells, they have Vajra flowers, they have Vajra everything. When they put Vajra in front of something, they're saying this object has got a pulsating reality to it. Yeah, it's alive. And of course, everything has. But they do it to pick particular ritual objects to try and make us remember that, yeah. So, you know, I come in and I bow to my cushion. It's not because I think my cushion really knows I'm bowing to it. Maybe it does, I don't know. I don't have that much faith in K-pop, but you never know. But I do it because I want to honour something there, you know. I want to honour what I'm doing. I want to recognize how I'm supported in doing that by a mat and a cushion in a room, in a shrine room. So I think what we're trying to do in a way is find ways of bringing meaning and richness into our lives and into the world. Well, it's already in the world, so it's more remembering or recognition of what's there. Yeah, what's really there. Anyway. And I'm sure all of you, at some point during these 2 weeks, have had a few, if not more, kind of memorable or magical moments where you've seen an animal, or you've seen a bird, or you've smelt a plant, you know, or you've tasted some food, where things will come a bit more alive, a bit more alive. And perhaps that's more than anything what we're trying to do. Be activated by the world and activate the world. You know? So a mutual kind of activation, a mutual kind of attraction, even love, you know, a mutual kind of love between us and the world. You know? The whole of our life, there's a When Death Comes poem, isn't there, where she says at the end, all my life I want to be a bridegroom taking the world in my hand. I want to be a bride, married to amazement, a bridegroom takes something like that. So I can't quite remember now, I'm trying to come back to me. Anyway, this idea of just really fully embracing our lives and fully embracing the world. Yeah. So I think that's what we've been about, and understanding that an essential part of this is the cultivation and taking care of the imagination. Yeah, because for a lot of us that becomes quite dulled as we become adults. Most of us, we have it as children, it's sort of just naturally there. We have it as children where the world is alive. You know, whether it's our stuffed toys, or whether it's the apple tree in the garden, whatever it is, you know, when you're a child, you're living in this vivid world, you know, this psychically active world, and somehow we lose this, and we don't have to lose it. We don't have to be childish to have it, and we don't have to lose it. We can be mature adults and still have this capacity to enjoy the world, yeah? Enjoy the world, to take pleasure in the world. I think it's Santayana, the philosopher who has this equation that actually beauty is a sort of, how did he put it, the sort of objective object of pleasure, I don't know if that makes any sense. So when we take pleasure in the world becomes beautiful. And when we don't take pleasure in the world, actually beauty disappears from the world, if that makes any sense. Yeah. It comes into being through us taking pleasure in something. Well, that's what beauty is. Yeah. And it's personified in particular objects or things. Anyway. So I hope that gives you a bit. And we've done it through this sort of strange alchemical metaphor, which what I like so much, and there's so much we haven't explored. It's such a rich, I think there's some books out now. Is that just nice to see you put some books out?
Yeah.
So you can look at some of the images, because in a way it's a tradition of image more than text, or at least equally a tradition of image, if not more. And the images are very weird. And that sort of images that, of course, we are sometimes familiar with in dream, you know, those sort of images that exist somewhere inside our own psyches, yeah. They often come to us, you know. And they also exist in the world in a way. But we've explored it through this very, very sort of arcane, but nevertheless, what's so good about alchemy is that it's so bonkers that you can't take it literally. That's what's good about it. That's why it's so useful. It's so mad that you can't really take it literally. You have to take it metaphorically. You have to take it with a yellow eye, I'm going to say. I don't know why yellow eye. Only a blue eye, maybe. I don't even know what I'm talking about now. but you have to take it with an imaginative eye. You can't literalize it. And funny enough, it's the same for Buddhism. Although it's not quite as bonkers, so it's a little bit easier to take kind of literally. But actually, it's in the same area. Buddhism is an imaginative tradition. When we meditate, we imagine. To feel into our own bodies, to feel into our breath, to feel into the body, is an act of imagination. It doesn't mean it's false, and it doesn't mean it's not based in some sensate, some sensation or something, but it's still an act of imagination, And in a way that consciousness is in and of itself an act of imagination, an act of making image, reflective image. This is what we do. This is what consciousness is. The ability to make a reflective image that somehow mirrors both inner states and the outer world. They're not given, There's some... The world is not given to us. We are in a active relationship with it all the time. We are making the world and the world is making us. It's not just this given thing, In that way, Buddhism too is an imaginative endeavour. Yeah. Even if we take something as basic to Buddhism as compassion, of course, compassion is based in imagination. Without imagination, you've got no compassion whatsoever. Anyway, so that's what we've been up to, and